Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into something pretty fundamental, orthopedic trauma and musculoskeletal injuries.
Yeah, it's a huge topic. I mean, these kinds of injuries are super common reasons for people needing emergency care. You know, the obvious stuff, pain, swelling, maybe something looks bent out of shape.
Right, the deformity. But what our sources really hammer home is that this isn't just about, like, the scaffolding of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it supports us, protects organs, sure. But damage here, mm-hmm. it can often be a surrogate marker.
A warning sign.
Exactly. Like a heads up for maybe deeper, more serious stuff going on inside.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, the number one rule in assessment is always, always life over limb.
Okay.
You have to check for the immediate threats first. Are they breathing okay? Any major bleeding? Circulation issues? You sort that before you really dive into fixing the broken arm or leg.
Okay. Let's talk about that scaffolding then. So broadly, we split the skeleton into two main groups, right?
Yep.
You've got the axial skeleton, that's your core. Think spine, skull, ribs, sternum, the central pillar.
Exactly. And then hanging off that is the appendicular skeleton. Your shoulders, pelvis, arms, legs, all the bits that let us move around and interact.
And the key point is, a big trauma, like a car crash, it doesn't really care about those neat categories, does it?
Not at all. A high energy hit often messes up both. It can destabilize the core and damage the limbs at the same time.
Which brings us back to looking at the whole patient, not just the obvious break.
Always.
Let's zoom in a bit. The hand, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Such intricate movements. Where does the actual muscle power for, like, typing or intricate work come from?
It's actually a brilliant bit of design. Most of the heavy lifting, the real power for your hand, comes from bigger muscles up in your forearm.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they pull on these long tendons that run down into your fingers. The hand itself, it only has a few small intrinsic muscles, keeps it slim for dexterity, you know?
That makes sense. Oh. All the power generated upstream, keeping the business end lean and precise. Huh. Okay, let's contrast that with the lower body, the tibia. The shin bone, that sounds like a real workhorse.
It absolutely is. And it's surprisingly vulnerable because it's so close to the skin, easy to hit directly.
Right.
But the main thing is its job. That tibia supports something like 90% of your upper body weight.
Wow, 90%.
Yeah. So a break there isn't just painful, it's functionally a massive problem.
And it's not just about the force of an injury, is it? Age plays a big role, too. Our bones change.
They do. Bone density generally starts to decrease after maybe age 35 or so.
Okay.
And for women, that process can speed up quite a bit after menopause. Leads to conditions like osteoporosis.
Which means weaker bones.
Weaker bones, yeah. Higher risk of fractures, sometimes from really minor bumps or falls. You even see people lose a bit of height over time. It just changes how much force it takes to cause a break.
So when a break does happen from trauma, we talk about different kinds of force. Can you break those down?
Sure. Two main types. First, direct force. Pretty straightforward. Something hits the bone hard enough to break it right at the point of impact.
Like getting hit with a bat.
Exactly. Then there's indirect force. This one's a bit more subtle. The force hits one area, but the break happens somewhere else along the line.
How does that work?
Think about falling and landing hard on your heel. The impact's there, but the force travels up your leg, and you might actually fracture your hip or maybe higher up the leg bone where it's weaker.
Okay, so fractures, breaks in the bone. We know they happen from things like car crashes, falls, sports.
Yeah, high-energy events are common causes, but also underlying conditions sometimes, and how we classify them is important for treatment.
Right. You look at the direction of the break line, how many pieces there are. You mentioned cortices earlier.
Ah, yes. The cortex is basically the dense outer layer, the wall of the bone. So we look at whether the break goes through just one side of that wall or all the way through affects stability.
Gotcha. But the really critical distinction, clinically speaking, seems to be open versus closed.
Absolutely. Massive difference. An open fracture means the skin is broken over the fracture site.
Bone sticking out or just a wound connecting down to it.
Could be either. But the big risks there are immediate infection getting into the bone and potentially significant bleeding, you can see.
Okay, scary. But closed fractures where the skin's intact, they have their own hidden danger, right?
They do. Because even though you don't see the bleeding, it's happening internally around the bone ends. It forms a hematoma, a collection of blood.
And that causes swelling.
Right. And that swelling inside a confined space under the skin and fascia creates interstitial pressure. That pressure can build up so much.
Just start squeezing things. like blood vessels and nerves.
Exactly. It can compress them, cutting off blood flow or causing nerve damage. That's the silent threat with a closed injury, that internal pressure cooker.
Okay, wow, so that's bones. What about the supporting structures, ligaments, tendons?
Right, so if you damage the ligaments, the tough bands that connect bone to bone and stabilize joints, that's a sprain.
What does that look like?
Usually pain, definitely swelling, often bruising or discoloration around the joint, and the person really won't want to move or use that limb.
Makes sense. And if the joint itself actually comes apart?
That's a dislocation. If it's completely separated, it's a dislocation. If it's just partially out of place, we call it a subluxation. Basically, the joint surfaces aren't aligned properly anymore.
Okay. And muscles, pulling a muscle.
That's a strain.
Yeah.
Usually happens from a really forceful muscle contraction or stretching it too far too fast.
Like sprinting and pulling a hamstring.
Like classic example. You get pain, especially when you try to use that muscle, maybe some minor swelling, but usually not that obvious deformity you might see with a bad fracture or dislocation.
Which circles back to needing a system, especially when someone's had major trauma. That broken leg might look dramatic.
But it might not be the thing that kills them. So the primary survey, that initial check, is always about priorities. Mental status first, then the ABCDEs.
Airway, breathing, circulation, disability, like neurological status, and exposure, getting a look at the patient.
Right. Unless you walk up and the patient looks lifeless or they're spurting blood everywhere.
And the order changes.
Then it flips to CBDE. Control that massive hemorrhage first. Then worry about airway, breathing, and the rest. Stop the bleeding that's killing them fastest.
Got it. So you handle the big life threats. If there is a suspected fracture or dislocation, what's the next crucial step for that limb?
Stabilize it before you move the patient, if possible. And the absolute key check, both before and after you do anything to that limb, like splinting it, is check the distal pulse.
Pulse downstream from the injury.
Yep. And check motor function. Can they wiggle fingers or toes? In sensation, can they feel you touching them? That tells you if the blood supply and nerves are intact. Any change is a red flag.
Okay. Then in the more detailed check, the secondary assessment for that specific limb, there's this mnemonic.
Mm.
The six P's sounds important.
It is. It's your quickfire checklist for whether that limb is in immediate danger from compromised circulation or nerve function.
Okay, what are they?
They are pain, especially pain that seems way worse than the injury should cause.
Out of proportion pain.
Exactly. Then paralysis, inability to move. Paresthesias, that's numbness, tingling, pins and needles.
Root care.
Pulselessness, no pulse below the injury. Very bad sign. Pallor of the skin looks pale, whitish, compared to the other limb. And pressure of the limb feels tight, tense, swollen.
Wow. So if you start ticking off several of those.
You've got a limb-threatening emergency on your hands. Time is critical. Beyond those P's, you're also looking closely inspecting for any deformity, comparing it to the uninjured side, looking for swelling, bruising.
And feeling it. Palpation.
Yeah, carefully feeling for specific points of tenderness, any instability where it shouldn't be, and listening or feeling for crepitus.
What's crepitus?
It's that gritty, grinding feeling, or sometimes even a sound you can hear when broken bone ends rub together.
Ugh.
Yeah. And again, always compare to the good side. Sometimes subtle swelling or a slight difference in shape is your only clue.
Okay, assessment done. Now, managing these injuries, what are the main goals?
Top priorities. Control any external bleeding. Prevent infection, especially with those open fractures. Try to limit internal bleeding and swelling. And immobilize the injury.
Right. For the simpler stuff like sprains, there's another mnemonic, RICES.
Yep. Classic advice. Rest the injured part. Ice it to reduce swelling and pain. Compression, like with an elastic bandage, again, for swelling. Elevation, get it above the heart if possible. And S sometimes stands for splinting or stabilization.
Let's talk about ice and heat. There are rules there, right?
Yeah, important ones. Ice or cold packs are your friend for the first, say, 48 hours. Helps constrict blood vessels, reduces swelling, numbs the pain a bit.
And heat.
You definitely want to avoid heat during that initial acute phase, maybe the first 48 to 72 hours.
Why is that?
Heat does the opposite. It opens up blood vessels, increases blood flow. You don't want more swelling and inflammation right at the start. Later on, though, after a couple of days, heat can be good.
To loosen things up.
Yeah, increase blood flow to help with stiffness and healing. But ice first is the rule of thumb.
Okay. Now, splinting. That seems central to managing fractures and dislocations. What are the big benefits?
Huge benefits. Mechanically, it stops the broken ends from moving around. That decreases pain significantly. It reduces the risk of those sharp bone ends causing more damage to muscles, nerves, or blood vessels nearby.
Okay.
And by keeping things still, it helps control that internal bleeding too. Less movement, less bleeding into the tissues.
Makes sense. Are there critical rules for applying a splint?
Absolutely. First, you need to be able to see the injured area if possible. Don't cover it completely if you don't have to. Second, and this is non-negotiable, assess PMS pulse, motor sensation distal to the injury before you apply the splint.
Check the circulation and nerves.
Yes, then you apply the splint, and then you immediately check PMS again.
To make sure the splint itself didn't compromise anything.
Precisely. For fractures, the rule is immobilize the bone itself, plus the joint above and the joint below the break.
Okay, stabilize across joints.
Yeah. For dislocations, you generally splint the joint and the bones on either side of it in the position you found it. Unless you're trained to reduce it, don't force it.
And the big caveat.
Splinting is important, but it should never delay getting a patient with critical life threats to the hospital. Fix the immediate killers first.
Right. And there are different types of splints for different jobs.
For sure. For suspected femur fractures, mid-shaft femur, we often use a traction splint.
What does that do?
It applies a steady, gentle pull along the length of the leg, helps align the broken bone ends, reduces painful muscle spasms, and really importantly, it helps control bleeding by reducing the space the hematoma can form in. Again, check PMS after applying it.
Okay, what else?
You've got pneumatic splints or air splints or like inflatable sleeves, good for lower leg or forearm fractures. The air pressure provides stability and also helps slow bleeding and swelling. And for really simple things like a broken finger or toe, you might just use buddy splinting tape, the injured digit, to the healthy one next to it. Just make sure not to tape over the joints themselves or cut off circulation.
All right, let's move into some of the really serious, sometimes hidden complications. Compartment syndrome sounds ominous.
It is. It's a true surgical emergency. Basically, you have muscle groups wrapped in this tough, inelastic connective tissue called fascia-forming compartments.
Okay.
If you get significant swelling inside that compartment from bleeding after a fracture, severe bruising, edema, or sometimes even just a splint or cast that's way too tight.
The pressure builds up inside.
Exactly. The pressure gets so high it starts to squeeze off the blood flow within that compartment. The muscle tissue and nerves inside start to suffocate and die.
And you mentioned earlier losing the pulse is a late sign. So irreversible damage could already be happening.
Yeah.
What's the early warning sign?
The absolute classic number one sign is pain that is completely out of proportion to the injury itself. We're talking searing, burning, deep pain that maybe isn't relieved by pain meds. The patient might be frantic.
Okay, pain out of proportion, that's the key.
That's the giant red flag. Management is urgent. Elevate the limb, but only to the level of the heart, not higher. Apply cold packs and immediately loosen or remove any tight bandages, splints, or clothing and need surgical release fast.
Wow. Okay. Even scarier, maybe, is crush syndrome. What's going on there?
This is bad. It happens when a part of the body, usually a limb, is trapped under significant compressive force for a prolonged period, think 4 to 6 hours or more. A building collapse, industrial accident.
So the tissue is being crushed for hours.
Right. And during that time, the muscle cells die, break down necrosis. They release their contents, stuff like potassium, myoglobin, and other toxins into the local area.
But it's trapped there by the crushing object.
For now, the
Yeah.
danger comes when you release that pressure, when you lift the heavy object off.
All that toxic stuff floods into the bloodstream at once.
Boom! A massive systemic hit. It can cause shock, severe kidney damage leading to renal failure. Dangerous heart rhythms from the potassium. It's a physiological time bomb.
So you can't just like lift the concrete slab off immediately.
Not without preparation and ideally under medical direction. Before you release that limb, you need to think about the systemic effects. Get IV access, give oxygen, start pushing fluids, a bolus of crystalloid solution to try and dilute the toxins when they hit the circulation. You absolutely need to consult medical control.
Mitigate the fallout before it happens. Wow,
Wow.
okay. What other potential complications? Blood clots.
Yeah, thromboembolic disease is definitely a risk, especially after major lower limb surgery or trauma or just being immobilized for a long time. Deep vein thrombosis, DVT, a clot in the leg veins.
And that can travel.
That's the big danger. If a piece of that clot breaks off and travels to the lungs, it causes a pulmonary embolism or PE.
What are the signs of a PE?
Sudden shortness of breath, sharp chest pain that gets worse when breathing in, rapid heart rate, rapid breathing. It's a life-threatening emergency, often happening days or weeks after the initial injury.
Okay, let's touch on a few specific high-energy fractures. Pelvis fractures sound serious.
Very serious. Usually takes massive force. You have to assume there might be other injuries nearby, a bladder, urethra, major nerves, big blood vessels.
And the bleeding risk. You mentioned that earlier.
It's huge. Especially those fractures caused by front-to-back compression, like in a head-on crash. The pelvic wing gets disrupted, and there's a massive network of blood vessels back there that can tear. People can bleed out internally very quickly from a pelvic fracture.
So manage rate involves?
Monitoring closely for shock, getting IV access ready, and often applying a pelvic binder. It's a special strap that goes around the hips over the bony prominences called the greater trochanters to help squeeze the pelvis back together and slow down that internal bleeding.
Okay. Femur fractures the thigh bone, also high energy.
Usually, yeah. Shaft fractures, mid-bone. Causes intense pain, the leg often looks shorter and might be rotated outwards. Big risk of significant blood loss into the thigh, too.
And another specific risk with femur fractures.
Fat embolism. Little globules of fat from the bone marrow can get into the bloodstream and travel to the lungs, similar to a blood clot PE, but caused by fat. Requires good IV access, pain control, and usually that traction splint we talked about.
Right. Quickly, upper extremity, any common patterns to know?
Definitely. Right. The collis fracture is classic, breaking the distal radius, the forearm bone near the wrist, usually from falling onto an outstretched hand. Gives that characteristic dinner fork look.
Okay.
And the boxer's fracture, breaking the neck of the fifth metacarpal, the bone in the hand leading to the little finger. Typically from, well, punching something hard.
Makes sense.
With any of these, any arm or hand injury, really, that neurovascular exam checking pulse, movement, sensation is critical and needs repeating. Hashtag tag outro.
Okay, this has been quite the deep dive. It really highlights that dual focus needed in trauma, doesn't it? You see the obvious broken bone.
But you have to constantly be thinking about what you can't see. Is pressure building up dangerously inside that limb? Is there massive internal bleeding from that pelvic injury? Are they developing systemic problems?
Right. It's about managing the visible injury while staying vigilant for those silent killers.
Exactly. And that's really the so what here, isn't it? Good pre-hospital care, stabilizing things properly, recognizing these complications early, getting the patient to the right hospital quickly. It makes a massive difference in long-term outcome.
Reducing disability, preventing infection.
Minimizing pain, preventing further damage. It sets the stage for better recovery down the line.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. We tend to think of a broken bone as, you know, a localized problem. Get a cast, it heals. But when you consider things like compartment syndrome, with that searing pain totally out of proportion.
Or crush syndrome, where simply releasing pressure hours later can trigger kidney failure.
Yeah, how does that change how you think about the real severity of some of these musculoskeletal injuries, especially when nerves or blood flow are potentially involved? It's often much more than just a break, isn't it? Something to really consider.